And now we'll have Professor Valerie Steves. Thank you.
Do you mind if I move your computer? Who needs technology? Hi, it's a real pleasure to be here this morning. over the past 2 years, excuse me, I have adult whooping cough. I'm not contagious, I promise, but I might cough a lot. Over the past 2 years, I've had the privilege of talking to young people across the country about their online experiences. And I've undertaken that research in the context of two research projects. You've already heard about the eGirls project that I co-lead with my colleague Jane Bailey. I'm also the lead researcher on Media Smart's Young Canadians in a Wired World project. Now, both of these projects are the results that I'm drawing from the qualitative work that I've done in the context of both of those projects, which, as you know, isn't generalizable. But I would suggest that it provides a really interesting window on kids' online lives. In the Young Canadians project, we followed up our qualitative interviews and focus groups with a survey of 5,500 students across the country between the grades 4 and grade 11 in all provinces and territories. And in my comments this morning, I will be drawing out some small pieces of that data because we're still in the process of our preliminary analysis, but the full report will be available in the new year, and we have quite a hefty section on cyberbullying, so I'm really looking forward to getting into that data. But what I'd like to do is give you a sense of how our research participants see the problem and the kinds of interventions that they're looking for to help them deal with the problem. And I'm going to structure my comments around two stories. The first occurred in Toronto. We were talking to a group of 13 to 14-year-old kids, brought up the internet, and boy, they had lots to say. Two of the young girls in this group were best friends. And somebody raised the issue of cyberbullying, and they just, rolled eyes. In fact, it was really interesting because whenever cyberbullying came up, that was probably the single topic that they were most vituperative about. And so these two girls said, oh, let us tell you about cyberbullying. I went on vacation, one girl says, in March break, and I came back from vacation, and I was goofing around with my best friend online because we had been comparing skin color. Both of these girls happened to be black. And the one who was down south said, ha, I'm blacker than you. And they were brought into the principal's office. They were threatened with suspension. They were disciplined because that conversation was seen by the school authorities as a kind of bullying. And in fact, this is one of the most common stories we heard. The children we talked to told us that the adults in their lives consistently misinterpreted a lot of their interactions, and many of their day-to-day communications were redefined as bullying. Now, once the problem was defined as cyberbullying, it became really difficult for them because they then told us that they lost control over the process. And I think this really relates to Senator Jaffer's comments that we tend to use criminal or quasi-criminal procedures to help kids learn how to be civil to each other. So because of that, they felt they lost control of the process, and they didn't feel that they were given an opportunity to be taken seriously or to become part of the solution. And they said that whether they were positioned as a victim of cyberbullying, as a perpetrator, or as a bystander. They also told us that the zero tolerance policies, which are very common in Canadian schools to deal with this kind of conflict, lump everything together, independent of whether or not they pose a problem for the child involved. So one of the questions we asked in our quantitative survey of these 5,500 kids across the country was, has anyone ever said anything to you online that was cruel or mean, that made you feel badly about yourself? And 37% of students says, oh yeah, that's happened to me. It is a gendered phenomenon. It was slightly higher for girls, slightly lower for boys, but it came out about 37%. But then we asked a follow-up question, and we said, okay, if that's true, how many of you said that this was, you know, how many of you felt that this was a problem? And 70% of the kids who had said that someone had said something mean to them said that it was never or rarely a serious problem for them. Only 9% of them said that this kind of behavior is a continuing problem, which works out to about 3% of the population. And the numbers are even lower when we look at the data that we collected on whether kids had been verbally threatened online. Now, all of this, our propensity to misinterpret, our propensity to take control of the issue away from kids and to apply zero tolerance policies instead of relying on teachers' discretion or the adults in these kids' lives to help them learn how to communicate in a more effective and fairer way, makes it harder for the adults on the ground to identify those situations that require intervention. And even more problematic, it makes it harder for those adults to intervene in ways that work for that smaller percent of kids that really need the help the most. Moreover, many of the policies that we've created to deal with these kinds of problems and to protect those kids that are most at risk of harm rely on constant surveillance. So a number of the parents we talked to across the country said, we're so worried about what our kids do online that we insist that they give us their social media passwords. They want us to friend them on Facebook. They used other relatives, and the words they used were to spy on their kids and report back so they could see if they were going to make any mistakes in their communications online. Schools had the kids under almost constant surveillance. This goes well beyond keystroke monitoring and content blocks in the classroom. Many of the kids were lived in areas where the schools regularly use software to parse their comments when they were doing their homework on educational intranets to make sure that they weren't saying words that they could be punished for. The teachers that we talked to across the country told us that this reliance on surveillance interferes with the privacy of the classroom. And they said that a learning environment has to be private in order to be a safe space for experimentation so you can actually talk to kids and they can talk to you. And our reliance on surveillance was actually making it harder to teach kids about digital citizenship, primarily because it meant that teachers lost those teachable moments. One teacher we talked to in the North said that when he wanted to take his kids online to talk with another school through a social media platform, he had to get permission from his school and it was all under surveillance. But he first had to get, he set up an internet in the classroom, and he said, why don't you guys just goof around on it? So, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes, somebody says something obnoxious. And that was a teachable moment. He could say, okay, let's talk about it. How does that make you feel? Is that the kind of way you talk to each other face to face? Those kinds of teachable moments where adults can really intervene on the ground and help kids learn how to behave civilly are lost because of our reliance on surveillance. But I think most interesting is the fact that the kids we talked to saw this surveillance as a profound lack of trust on the part of adults. And this put them into a real quandary. They've incorporated online media into their social lives. They use these media to try on new identities, to deepen their social relationships, to explore the world around them and their place in it. But the surveillance that they're placed under magnifies their mistakes and interferes with their developmental need for privacy, especially as they enter their teen years. Now, they get that adults want to help. They're particularly sympathetic to parents. And they figure that their parents have their best interests at heart. But this kind of surveillance made it more difficult for them to go to their parents and say, hey, I've got a problem. Somebody said something, I don't know how to respond to it, primarily because, as again Senator Jaffer alluded to, they're afraid they'll lose access to the technology. Interestingly enough, we were told by our participants that it also made it impossible for them to talk to a teacher they trusted, because the teacher, under zero tolerance policies, was required to report it to the principal, that was required to report it to the school resource officer, so to the police. And the kids knew that. So when they needed adult help, the surveillance and the mechanisms that we've put in place to protect them made it harder for them to get that help, not easier. So I think we need to think far more critically about the kinds of interventions we're using and instead focus on kids' needs. And to illustrate the kinds of issues that we saw coming up in our work with kids across the country, I'd like to tell you another story. I said much of this bullying is gendered. We were talking to one-on-one interviews with young women in the Ottawa Valley, so in a rural area. And this young woman came in and she raised the question of cyberbullying, and she kind of whispered it. And up until then, she had been presenting as, you know, I've got my act together. I use the internet to promote my, she was a bit older, she was 21, so I use it to promote my business, and I communicate with my family, and it's great. But then she talked about when she was in grade 9. You know, when I was in grade 9, I was desperate to be one of those girls. And I don't look like one of those girls, and I'd never really been one of those girls, but I was desperate to be one of those girls. And so I did the makeup, I did the dieting, I did everything. And it seemed to be working. I was friends with that crowd. And then one day, I go onto one of these girls' Facebook pages, and there's a she's posted a picture of this other girl's posted a picture of the other girl and the young woman I'm talking to. And another girl had posted, well, we all know why you put up that picture, LOL. And the girl looked at it and said, I don't know. So she went to this girl in the hallway and she said, what's up with this? I mean, you put a picture of us hanging out together and someone's made the sarcastic comment. What does it mean? And the other girl looked at her and said, oh, come on, surely you have to know. And she said, no. And she said, well, it's because you're fat. You make me look good. That's why I put that picture up there. And this sent this young girl who had a very fragile sense of self into a real spiral. And she became involved in all sorts of very, very destructive behavior. And it took her a good 4 years to get over it. And interestingly enough, it was her aunt that helped her, because she trusted her, she could talk to her, and she could help her deal with it. Now, although this is at the most extreme end of the kinds of problems that kids told us about across the country, it was also an incredibly common tale. The girls we talk to in particular are under unbelievable pressure to look a certain way, to act a certain way, and it's a highly gendered performance. I was talking to one 15-year-old in Ottawa. We're sitting in my office, and I say, so do you post pictures on Facebook? Because we were talking about Facebook, and she goes, oh, God, no, I never do that. I'm thinking, yay, finally a girl who's, you know, rebelling and won't fall into this. And she said, and so I said, oh, how come you don't do that? She says, well, it's because I'm ugly. I know I'm ugly. I'm not going to put my face up there so those nasty people can tell me I'm ugly and, you know, blankety blank them kind of thing. And it broke my heart for these kids that we talked to, because they had internalized these messages that are coming to them because of the commodification and commercialization of their social environment. When you're on Facebook, you're in a store. When you're on Twitter, it's going to be a store too. And that changes their social relationships in really problematic ways. And I think the best example of that was our conversation about confidence. So I was talking to a number of young kids. Jane was there. It was through the eGirls Project. And they were talking about, you know, well, why would a girl, you know, post up a bunch of lingerie shots? Because apparently this is really cool when you're 15 to put up lingerie shots. And all the girls said, that's confidence. That's because they're confident. So sort of teased this away and said, well, what is it that makes that a confident thing? And they say, okay, you take the pictures in the privacy of your own bedroom, and then you really carefully parse which ones you're going to put up. And then you pick the ones that you think make you look the best, and you stick them up, and then you watch your site like a hawk. And if you don't get multiple likes in 10 minutes, if you do get likes, you're confident. So if your friends come on and say, like, quickly, that means I'm confident. I can display my body. People like it. But if nobody comes on and likes you within 10 minutes, you're humiliated, you take it down, and that's confidence. So these kids are operating in a mediatized environment where it's imperative for them to be sexy but not too sexy. Jane alluded to the kind of slut-shaming that we heard about. It's a line that's almost impossible to navigate. In our quantitative study, we asked about sexting. 9% of girls sexed, 8% of boys sexed. Looks fairly equal. It's very low in grade 7. It rises to about 15% for both genders in grade 11. So this is still not a mainstream thing to do. But the meaning of sexting is highly gendered. So all across the country, again, both in young Canadians and in e-girls, boys and girls would tell us, oh yeah, when a girl sexts her boyfriend, well, she's just being a good girlfriend. You know, girls would say, well, I'm not going to do that, but I understand. You know, that's just being fair to your boyfriend. It's seen as a reasonable part of their relationship. But, and here's where it gets really interesting, if the boyfriend passes it on, she's a slut. The boyfriend gets a free ride. He's never held to account for passing it on. But as soon as that picture leaves his phone, then she's the slut. There's no consequence for him, but her reputation is shot. Now, most of the participants we talked to said, well, that's just the way it is. You know, it might not be very fair, but social success is determined by your ability to either reproduce this highly stereotyped version of teenage life, or at least have a couple of friends on your Facebook page who are successful in reproducing it. Now, all of the kids we talked to readily identified mainstream media images as problematic, but they told us it was really, really hard to combat the stereotypical portrayals of gender that surround them, stereotypical portrayals of race, of ableism, of sexual orientation. Now, our findings suggest that social media not only replicate the centrality of these stereotypes, they amplify it in three interrelated ways. And when Senator Jaffer was saying, where should we look next, this is where I would point to. The first thing that we found is that the commercial surveillance on social media sites, the places where kids hang out online, intensifies their interactions with media representations and restructures the environment in ways that privilege these heteronormative performances. It's racialized, it has to do with ableism and all these kinds of intersecting factors that come together to create an unequal space online. To give you an example of what I mean by the way these things restructure the space, many years ago I was on an early social media site, and I had been doing research on it, so I hadn't identified myself in any way. So when I was on the site, and I was there for like 2 weeks reading all their legal policies and the fine print and yada, yada, yada. So my IP address had been around for a long time. And on the homepage, I got the news. Now, again, it was a very constructed view of the news. CNN type news. So it was a very particular view of the world. But I got world news. I got politics. I got sports. I got a whole variety of things. Then I created a fake persona on this site. I was a 16-year-old girl. I lived in Vancouver. I had a real address. It happened to be a warehouse. Because I wanted to see, I wanted to get into some of the functionality, and I wanted to see how the system would work as if I were a kid. And I was immediately redirected back to the homepage, and the world had disappeared. And all I had on my homepage was J-Lo and Ben summer, all about J-Lo and Ben, celebrity news, dieting ads, plastic surgery ads. I identified myself as a teen, and the site that I was on restructured my online environment in ways that should be really terrifying to us if we are taking digital citizenship seriously, in ways that cut off kids and ghettoize them and intensify certain kinds of commercial messages. So that commercial surveillance is really important to problematize. The second way that we suggest that social media amplify these problems, it's really linked to the message we've given parents and family members and teachers and school administrators that to protect kids you have to place them under surveillance. That places a real burden on kids because they're no longer able to maintain the boundaries between their various performances. So if you think of that young girl I told you about who had that terrible experience, she's portraying herself in a particular way in the same space where her parents are seeing it, her grandparents are seeing it, her peers are seeing it, and that creates a real burden. It becomes very, very difficult to maintain some sense of self when you're unable to determine the audience that you're interacting with. And I think that this suggests that increased surveillance monitoring of children actually exacerbates rather than helps them. If we want to help them, we need to talk to them. If we want them to talk to us, they need to trust us. And if we place them under surveillance, we really limit our ability to actually start those conversations. The third and last way that we think that social media actually amplify the problem of stereotypes is the visual nature of the medium itself. That particularly for girls, that visual emphasis alienates a feminine body through the hypervisibility of the image of the body. This makes the body an object of judgment that's subject to scrutiny by others, but also by the self. And it certainly exacerbates the negative effects of failed performances. So just in closing, I'd really like to echo what you've heard from Senator Jaffer and what you've heard from Professor Bailey, that when we're talking about these kinds of online conflicts, I think it's really important to realize we're talking about misogyny, we're talking about racism, we're talking about homophobia, we're talking about classicism, and we're talking about ableism. And if we're going to fix it, rather than trying to fix the kids, perhaps we should put our efforts in better understanding and regulating the environment that amplifies the impact of these very stereotypical representations of teenage life. Thank you.